This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Jeff Nally. Our guest this week is Jeff Cooper, President and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with RFA's Jeff Cooper next. Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net, providing individualized protection on more than 490 million acres of farmland. Crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Over 40 years ago, ethanol producers in the nation formed the Renewable Fuels Association with a mission of enhancing the nation's energy security and improving the environment. Today, RFA President and CEO Jeff Cooper says his industry is working to continue its mission against the headwinds of government emission standards and subsidies favoring electric vehicles. Cooper says the corn-based ethanol industry hasn't reached its full potential.
Today's corn-based ethanol, on average, is reducing greenhouse gas emissions by about 50% compared to gasoline, and that's including all the emissions associated with every step in that supply chain from the farm level, you know, from the time the farmer plants the seed, all the way until the fuel is distributed into the vehicle. So that's, you know, a 50% reduction today is a pretty darn good start. But where we see things going, Jeff, what is possible is a truly carbon neutral, net zero carbon emissions fuel. When you add carbon capture and sequestration, or other technologies and practices to today's existing ethanol industry, we see a future where we're producing zero carbon liquid fuel. Again, that can fit right into the light-duty motor vehicle sector, but can also go into things like aviation fuel, sustainable aviation fuel for the airlines. And again, there's a tremendous amount of investment and interest from that sector looking at the use of ethanol as a feedstock for low-carbon jet fuel moving forward. So that's where things are headed. There have been some policies adopted in the last few years that are helping stimulate that transition and helping with some of these investments. But, you know, we see a bright future for renewable fuels and ethanol specifically. And again, we hear a lot of talk about electric vehicles and boy, we're going to lose this gasoline market. Well, number one, we don't think it's quite as dire as that. But number two, there's a lot of opportunities outside of that traditional marketplace for ethanol moving forward.
How much help do you need from Washington? Or what is needed to allow the renewable fuels industry to achieve its potential both in growth and in environmental impact?
Well, the big thing, and it sounds kind of wonky and technical, but the one of our most important needs right now is recognition from this government that corn ethanol is indeed reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 50% or more. In order to qualify as a quote-unquote sustainable aviation fuel, and that means, you know, that's how you access the tax credits and some of the other helpful policy that's out there, you have to demonstrate that the fuel reduces GHG emissions by 50% or more. Right now there's a model called the Department of Energy GREET model that shows, yes, corn ethanol makes that, it's there. We meet that threshold. But there are some in Washington that are trying to obfuscate and confuse the issue and use other models and other methodologies to suggest that corn ethanol isn't as good as the Department of Energy says it is and therefore wouldn't qualify for some of these tax credits and really, you know, serve as a feedstock for some of these other markets. So that's the big one, is getting the greenhouse gas modeling right. Getting that correct, and that to me, to us, that means using the Department of Energy's GREET model, and we have been very active in advocating at the Department of Treasury and EPA and all across the administration that that's the model they should be using when they look at the GHG impacts of sustainable aviation fuels moving forward. That's the big one.
Jeff, does the administration use an apples-to-apples evaluation of electric vehicles versus piston engines?
The short answer to that is no, absolutely not. And that's our problem with the way that they are proceeding with these recent proposed regulations on vehicle standards. They assume that an electric vehicle is a zero emissions vehicle, and they allow the automaker to actually write a zero in for an electric vehicle when they are calculating their fleet-wide average emissions. And so, of course, that serves as an extremely compelling incentive for the automakers to make more electric vehicles. If they can count them as zeros, then they're going to make more of them. And, in fact, EPA projects that their most recent proposal, if it's what they finalize, it's going to really force automakers to produce 2 out of 3 of their new vehicles as battery electric vehicles by 2032. And that, again, that's all because they're not doing an apples-to-apples comparison. We have been suggesting all along that EPA needs to look at the full life cycle impacts of all fuels and vehicles. And for electricity, you know, for electric vehicles, of course, that includes how and where the electricity is generated and how and where the battery minerals are mined and how the battery is produced. All of that is being ignored by EPA today. And we just think it's not only intellectually dishonest, but it also creates a terribly unlevel playing field and discriminates against other low-carbon solutions that are out there today, like ethanol.
The EPA is proposing a set of rules to limit greenhouse gas and other emissions from all vehicles beginning in 2027. And I think your industry has said this ultimately is a de facto ban on internal combustion engines.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And EPA itself has admitted that if these are the regulations that they end up finalizing, it is going to compel or force the automakers to stop making as many internal combustion engine vehicles as they are today and dramatically increase their production of battery electric vehicles to meet these standards. That's the only way they're going to be able to meet these very stringent standards that have been proposed. And again, EPA says that by 2032, 67% of new vehicle sales will be electric vehicles under this proposal. That to us just is crazy. We think that's completely unachievable. But beyond that, it's not necessary. If the goal of this proposal is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, let's take a step back and be fair in how we are evaluating the ways to do that. We really need to open this regulation up and allow all low carbon fuel options and all low carbon vehicle options to compete fairly. And that's what we're asking EPA to do as it, you know, takes the steps to finalize this rule. But boy, what they proposed is nowhere close to a level playing field.
Over 60% of the electricity that's generated in the nation today is said to be from fossil fuels, each on either natural gas or coal. So if you were competing, in an evaluation of the complete life cycle, how would that measure up against an internal combustion engine with a ratio of renewable fuel in the tank?
Yeah, that's a great question, and there have been a number of studies and analyses that have looked at that very question, and what many of them have found is if you are looking at an electric vehicle that is running on coal-fired electricity and it's using minerals in its battery that were mined using intensive mining practices, that vehicle is certainly no better and is likely far worse on a life cycle carbon emissions basis than a internal combustion engine vehicle that is using a blend like E15 or E30 or certainly E85. If you're using a flex fuel, that's going to be a far better option for reducing emissions than the battery electric vehicle. And people just don't seem to get that. They don't seem to understand that when you're looking at a battery electric vehicle, Yes, it may not have a tailpipe, but the tailpipe for that vehicle is the stack at the power plant. And if that power plant is using coal or even natural gas, it's far from a zero emissions vehicle system. And again, vehicles using biofuels and ethanol specifically are going to have a better carbon footprint, a smaller carbon footprint than those electric vehicles.
Some people heard last week Jim Matheson was the guest on our open mic with the NRECA, and you can go back in the archive section at AgriPulse and listen to the interview. But Jim questioned if there was actually enough supply of electricity for all the influx of electric vehicles, and then mused further if the transmission lines in the nation, even the transformers, were adequate to meet the standards or at least the volume of electric vehicles that the administration is proposing.
Yeah, that's been a concern that many stakeholders are raising is even if it was feasible for the automakers to ramp up their production of electric vehicles to this extent, we've got to have a simultaneous build out of the infrastructure in this country to support that. And right now we don't have it. You're talking about you would need to increase electricity production substantially. Some estimates are, we would need another 30 to 40, maybe under some scenarios, as much as 50% increase in our current electricity generation to support a fleet that is fully electrified. That's not going to happen in the next 5 to 10 years, if ever. And again, where is that new electricity going to come from? Yeah, some of it may come from solar and wind, but to ramp up electricity generation that quickly is going to require continued use and probably increased use of fossil fuels. And it's also going to require, like you said, new transmission lines. It's going to require a massive build out in the charging stations for these vehicles. There's just a lot of things that would have to go right and a lot of things that would have to happen very quickly for this transition to really unfold the way EPA is envisioning.
Jeff, in your opinion, did Congress delegate this much authority to EPA?
Well, yeah, that's the other problem with this proposal, one of the other problems. EPA is grossly exceeding its authority with what they're trying to do here. The Congress did not give EPA the authority to phase out internal combustion engines. They did not give EPA the authority to essentially mandate electric vehicles. And there's some very recent validation of the fact that Congress did not intend for EPA to have that sort of authority. The Supreme Court just recently made it very clear that an agency must have clear congressional authorization if it's going to exercise significant powers. And that was part of this the West Virginia versus EPA case around the Clean Power Plant. So, I think the courts have very recently spoken to this, and I think that's a big question that EPA is going to face as they finalize this rule. And unless they change something in that final rule versus what they proposed, I would expect there to be quite a bit of litigation on this final rule.
Agriculture has been certainly encouraged of the potential of next-gen biofuels. Can this survive? Can these next-gen biofuels, can this industry survive with the administration's plans and regulations that are being offered?
Yeah, we can survive and will survive, and I think we will continue to grow. I think at some point there is going to be a really heavy dose of reality that sets in with this administration's plans around electrification.
Let's evaluate, if we can, the past three administrations and their policies toward renewable energy. Let's start with the Obama administration. What sort of success and what sort of headwinds did you find under President Obama and his EPA?
Well, we had some very steep headwinds with the Obama EPA, and in fact, that was the first time that we saw an administration really take the hatchet to the renewable fuel standard. Under President Obama, we had Administrator Gina McCarthy at EPA, who waived the renewable fuel standard based on this notion that, oh, we have this blend wall out there that really won't allow the marketplace to absorb more than 10% ethanol. And they bought into that notion at EPA and cut the RFS, and cut it significantly a few years. That resulted in us suing that administration, and ultimately we won that case. And we're still today seeing EPA make up for some of that illegally waived volume all the way back in the Obama administration years. So we certainly faced some challenges with the Obama administration. You know, they were the ones that also approved E15, but they did it in a way that made it very difficult for the marketplace to quickly embrace and adopt E15. We had this summertime barrier that still is in place today. You know, and that all came out of the Obama administration. So we had our hands full there. Then we went from there to the Trump administration. You know, again, kind of a mixed bag for renewable fuels. On one hand, we saw President Trump personally intervene and personally take interest in trying to resolve that E15 barrier, and he actually directed his EPA to fix that once and for all. They did that, but then, of course, the oil guys sued EPA, and the courts sided with the oil guys and overturned that E15 year-round regulation. But then at the same time, we had the Trump administration issuing dozens of those small refinery exemptions that were very quietly letting refiners out of their obligations to blend renewable fuels. And again, we had to take EPA to court over that situation. Again, we won. And again, we are still years later finally bouncing back from the demand destruction that we saw as a result of those waivers. So, you know, again, a mixed bag. And now with the Biden administration, I'll say they've been very solid on the RFS. They've been very solid on E15. You know, we've seen this administration grant emergency waivers this summer and last summer to allow the continued use of E15. We've seen this administration really get behind kind of that next generation for renewable fuels, sustainable aviation fuels, and on down the line. But where we've run into problems is, again, this idea that electric vehicles are going to be the savior of the transportation industry moving forward. And just this forced push of electrification, we think, is at odds and is really inconsistent with what the Biden administration has been trying to do on liquid renewable fuels.
So given the actions over the past three administrations, Jeff, is it time for Congress to step back in and clearly define what's intended?
Well, I think as it relates to the question around electric vehicles, yes. I think Congress is intending to do that. In fact, just yesterday, the House Energy and Commerce Committee marked up a bill that would prevent EPA from finalizing this latest tailpipe emissions proposal. So I do think this proposal certainly got Congress's attention. There's a lot of discussion today on the Hill about what Congress really meant and intended with its Clean Air Act authorities surrounding electric vehicles. And so I do think we are going to see further definition and further involvement and oversight from Congress around EPA's rules that are designed to force electrification.
What's the nation losing if it doesn't get behind renewable fuels and continues the path that it's on now?
Well, we started this conversation by talking about, you know, one of the founding pillars of the renewable fuels industry was energy security and decreasing dependence on foreign entities and foreign countries for our energy supplies. And we've done a great job of doing that over the last 15 or 20 years. We're in a pretty good place when it comes to having a secure and mostly independent energy supply here in the U.S. However, if we keep going down this road toward electrification, we're going to reverse that trend. And the reason for that is we are going to be reliant on countries like China and Bolivia and the Congo for the minerals and the batteries that are powering these vehicles. We don't have those minerals here in the U.S. We just don't have them. When you look at the proven reserves of the minerals that are needed for these batteries, they just unfortunately don't exist in the U.S. in any significant supply. So you got to go to places like China, Bolivia, Russia, for these minerals. And, you know, most of these batteries today are being produced in China as well. So we're, worried, I would say, that if we keep rushing down this road toward electrification, we're going to be putting our country right back in a situation where we're dependent on adversarial countries for, you know, key materials and energy supplies. But instead of petroleum this time, it's going to be those minerals that go in the batteries.
Are there other countries in the world that are using higher blends in combustion engines and achieving greenhouse gas goals?
Oh, absolutely there are, and really the shining example is what they're doing in Brazil. I mean, today in Brazil, about 50% of their liquid fuel consumption is biofuels, and that's mostly ethanol. You know, just about everybody in Brazil is driving a flex fuel vehicle or a vehicle that can operate on nearly 100% ethanol, and the minimum amount of ethanol blended in Brazil today is about 27%. So we've seen, you know, the success story in Brazil with ethanol, and there are other examples. I mean, you look at a place like India, where 10 years ago, they were using very little ethanol. They made it a national priority, again, because of energy security reasons and environmental reasons, to increase their use of ethanol. They quickly moved to a 10% nationwide average. And they have every intention of moving to an E20 nationwide blend, a 20% ethanol blend. So there are other countries that get it, and unfortunately, they're moving faster and further than the U.S. We've always been a world leader when it comes to ethanol, but we've got other countries that are passing us by right now because they're taking a more practical, more pragmatic approach to reducing carbon emissions. And doing it in an affordable way for their consumers. Whereas we're all focused on electric vehicles here in the U.S., we've got other countries that are looking at biofuels as that solution.
Well, Jeff Cooper, we want to thank you for taking time at a busy season, certainly in the summer driving season, and the work that's going on in Washington to spend with us on this edition of Open Mic. Jeff Cooper, it is Open Mic, and today you've got the last word.
Well, thanks for having me, Jeff. And I guess the last thing I would want to say is, again, all we're asking for in the ethanol industry is a level playing field. We're asking for a chance to compete and to do that fairly. And unfortunately, with these most recent regulations from EPA around electric vehicles, we don't have that currently. Around E15, we don't have that because we're blocked from, you know, selling E15 in the summer months. You know, we hear a lot of people talk about, well, we ought to have a free market when it comes to energy, and so we, you know, shouldn't have the RFS and we shouldn't have these other things. If we truly had a free marketplace, I guarantee you that we would be using more than 10% ethanol on average. Ethanol is a lower cost fuel. It's a cleaner fuel. It's made domestically in America. It reduces dependence on foreign oil. So, of course, that's the product that would be chosen by consumers if we truly had a free and open marketplace. So all we're asking for is a level playing field. Let us compete with electric vehicles head to head and, you know, let the consumer decide on what option makes the most sense for reducing emissions, cleaning up the environment, and doing it in the most affordable and economic way for American families.
Our thanks to Jeff Cooper, President and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Jeff Nally.